Dan to Cody, from Gillette to Rock Springs, this is Let's Talk Wyoming, your weekly dose of Wyoming politics. Because politics may be complicated, but I'm here to break it down and help you make sense of it all. I'm Amy Edmonds, former legislator from Cheyenne. Thanks for being here. Welcome back to another episode of Let's Talk Wyoming. I'm Amy Edmonds. Recently, I sat down with Representative Rob Geringer to unpack the factional fracture ripping through our legislature. Rob had written a wonderful piece that was in the Cowboy State Daily. We had a great discussion, and I hope you enjoy it. But since that conversation, yet another example of that fracture and the factionalism that has taken root in the Wyoming House of Representatives has reared its rather ugly head in Wyoming in the form of some political news. And let me just say, it's not subtle, okay? We've got homegrown redcoats parading into the Joint Appropriations Committee meeting this week in Gillette, Wyoming, like the Red Army, complete with bobbleheads, endlessly nodding their head yes, like the yes men many Freedom Caucus members are being accused of. Talk about commitment to the bit. I mean, I can't make this stuff up, but I tried. Like I said, this past Tuesday, a handful of Wyoming representatives, most of them public Freedom Caucus members, some of them part of the don't ask, don't tell institutionalized deception the Freedom Caucus allows, they came to the appropriations meeting in matching red coats. Why? I mean, I can be honest with you, when I first saw them, I just thought maybe they had gone to like some Shriner breakfast, because it didn't make any sense. Why are they wearing red coats, coordinated matching outfits? And no offense to the Shriners and all the good work they do, but I couldn't figure it out. Well, I had to wait. According to the long monologue by Chairman John Baer, which he gave at the beginning of the meeting, they were wearing the jackets to theatrically warn of a looming budget deficit. Get it? Budget deficit. Red in the red, budget deficit, right? But they were all smiles, right? We've got all these pictures of them grinning from ear to ear, smiling and happy. They were all smiling about this potential future, which is not a great future for Wyoming, potentially, which is odd. It's really odd, and it's really inappropriate behavior. But what really, really got me, is that they brought these bobblehead dolls, right? Made to look like them. So custom ordered to look like them, that I can only assume they had made so they could place them on their desks. And then the ensemble was completed with these Doge trucker hats, replete with the trademark Wyoming Bucking Bronco, right? Because nothing screams fiscal responsibility like spending a whole bunch of your own money on theater props when you're not actually in the theater. I mean, these are elected lawmakers, members the voters have sent to represent them, wearing ridiculous red jackets, trucker hats, and holding bobbleheads while they grin from ear to ear for photographs to mark that Wyoming may be headed for a fiscal deficit, which is a big deal because the Wyoming legislature will have to pick and choose and people will lose things. But they were grinning. So we can only assume that mercifully, the five and dime plan, their earlier sort of shtick that they brought out at the beginning of the last legislative session in January, now that that's died on the ashes of the session, that this new performative playbook for the Freedom Caucus is to dress up, to nod at themselves with their desk dolls nodding away, and then call out everyone else for overspending. And I just want to say, thinking about the five and dime plan, which was easily mocked, right, as a nickel and dime and all of this other stuff. And now with the red coats, right, the turncoats, the red coats, wearing the red coats, these people do not think through their marketing. I just want to make this point clear, because this is just silly stuff, right? I mean, this is really, really silly to play this performative game and to have these, you know, all come coordinated in this red jacket. It seems as though they're positioning themselves as red coats, right? But not out of some kind of patriotism, but more like a loud signal that they're really trying to ditch responsibility for our state's future in favor of this performative politics, which I've heard they want to take on the road. I mean, I just sit in horror at this thought, because here's the deal. These are not serious people. Okay. Let me just repeat that. These are not serious people. Serious people don't behave like this. When you are a leader and you are facing a potential fiscal deficit, you hold a somber press conference, where you talk about it and you let the voters and you let the citizens out there, the people of whom there are constituencies that depend upon this money, the people that are marginalized, the people that are DD waivers, people that have real issues in their lives. You hold a somber press conference. You don't wear red jackets, grinning from ear to ear, holding ridiculous toys, wearing trucker hats. Serious people don't behave like that. I served on the Appropriations Committee, and watching that circus this week at the opening and then the remedial committee meeting that followed on the first day to try and get these folks up to speed on just the basics about, on that day they were talking about firefighting and fire suppression and how we're going to fight all of these potential wildfires in the future was beyond embarrassing. I mean, just to be honest with you, it was beyond embarrassing. They may not have the good sense to be embarrassed for themselves, but I was. So what do we really have here? We have the Freedom Caucus faction declaring itself a faction by wearing matching red jackets, brandishing these dolls, and using this grandstanding gimmick instead of doing what the voters expect them to do, which is the hard work of finding actual policy solutions. Here's the thing. They want an election. They own the problems of this state, at least on the House side. But it's something they are clearly deeply uncomfortable with because they aren't up to the task of solving it, I suspect. And so we have performative politics. We have red coats, dolls, you know, desk dolls, trucker hats, and talk of everyone else being responsible for Wyoming's problems. But boy, oh boy, not them. Despite the fact that they've been in charge, they've gone through a legislative session, they have a majority. Boy, oh boy, it is not their problem. That's not leadership. It isn't. They're not serious people. The bobbleheads, the red jackets, these are not, you know, bold statements. They're distractions from the fact that they have no idea what they are doing. So my conversation with Representative Geringer, who is a serious lawmaker, is a timely one this week, I think, as we dive into what factionalism really looks like. And just, by the way, shout out, thanks to the Freedom Caucus for that visual representation this week to punctuate this podcast. But we dive into what factionalism looks like and why it's intellectually lazy and harmful to the overall process of leading. I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Let's Talk Wyoming. If politics is the art of the possible, then factionalism is the art of sabotage. Wyoming's legislature, long known for its civility and cowboy common sense, has hit choppier waters in recent years. We've all witnessed a lot more arguing and a whole lot fewer solutions. At the center of it all, factionalism, or so Representative Rob Geringer has said. And I think he's exactly right. It's not just a buzzword, it's a red flag. When legislative groups become more loyal to internal alliances than to the people they serve, trust breaks down. Lawmakers stop talking to each other, good policy gets strangled by bad policy, and voters are left wondering, who's actually calling the shots? Representative Rob Geringer recently raised the alarm in an op-ed you can find at Cowboy State Daily, arguing that the Wyoming House is gripped by factionalism that threatens our ability to govern. His mission was clear. This isn't about one group. It's about the culture we're creating. We all share in this problem, and we all need to share in its solution. I invited him on today again, not to fan the flames, but to talk about how we cool things down, how we get back to a legislature that serves the state, not the factions. Representative Geringer, it's great to have you back.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be back.
Wonderful. So you had a really great op-ed piece in the Cowboy State Daily. And I, for all the listeners, I will link that in the show notes so you can go find it and read it. But what prompted you to write that op-ed piece now? I mean, was there a situation, a moment that made you feel this message was needed?
You know, there wasn't really a single moment, but just kind of a buildup over time. I think we've all seen how quickly disagreement is treated as betrayal. You know, good people, principled conservatives are being, I don't know, sidelined or labeled for just having a different perspective, even, you know, different strategy or a difference in the process on how things get done. And so when we look at how that happens, it really, and I guess I would even say there's even moderates that have good ideas that maybe can work for conservatives and are really being ignored because of their position on certain issues. And so it really kind of feels like we're losing sight of what our system, our process was designed to protect, you know, to have that deliberation, the balance, and really just a civility, a mutual respect.
Yeah. Yeah. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the term, why don't you define the factionalism in the legislative context for them?
Yeah. In that context, factionalism is when a group of lawmakers or legislators becomes more committed to their internal loyalty or group loyalty or ideological identity than to the institution itself or the process or even shared values. So it's not the same as having strong beliefs. We can have strong beliefs, but it's more about how they pay attention more to what their group is saying or their internal beliefs and shutting people out because of that.
Yeah. In your piece, you talked about factionalism really in a way that I think the reader came to the obvious conclusion that it can weaken trust. And I would like to see if you can unpack that a little bit, just not just trust in the institution, but trust between you all as lawmakers together, because you're working together through processes, whether it's the interim work that you do or when you're actually in session. So unpack that idea a bit. Does it show up in day-to-day legislative work?
Yeah, I think it does. We saw it in the session. I don't, at least in my experience so far in the committee work, I haven't seen it as much, but we see it even in the press. But it really, when you can't trust someone to hear your idea unless you're part of that faction, it shuts down the conversation. And let me take a step back too. The factionalism isn't just maybe certain caucuses within one party. It's both sides of the aisle. It's any particular issue that can drive the wedge in between people. And so when we have that lack of trust, people start or stop really offering maybe amendments. They stop offering their opinion, talking about what different ideas may come up that may be better. They really just becomes a zero-sum game, and that erodes, I guess, the collaboration that really policymaking depends on.
Yeah. Well, I think that is really dangerous to the long-term ability for the body to do that work. You know, when I think about long-term risks to the institution, Wyoming has had a really long history of kind of working out differences, working, you know, all these from water rights to education. You know, we've solved, I think, a lot of tough problems through compromise, which I've talked a little bit about compromise. And for some people, it's been that word has been weaponized, that it's somehow a super negative thing, when in actuality, of course, our founders intended to create a system where we could all work out these differences. So compromise is a natural product of that sort of thing. So thinking overall about like the long-term risks to the institution, Wyoming has had a long history of working across big differences, right? In solving issues from water rights to education, we've solved a lot of tough problems. I think it takes compromise. And I've talked a lot about compromise in other podcasts. It's a word that I think has really been sort of weaponized to mean something completely different, that it's a bad thing that somehow we can't compromise. And I think the framers obviously intended for a system in which the obvious outcome was going to be compromise. How do you take two different views and come to a middle ground? So how do you, or what do you think are the long-term risks inside the institution if this kind of, you know, sort of weaponization and factionalism continue?
Well, and when you talk about compromise, it does tend to be a dirty word with some people. And I guess my view on it is that there's definitely a need at times to compromise. You don't have to compromise your values. You can still work to achieve the goal. When you start taking that hard line in it has to be my way and no other way, then you lose the ability to have the dialogue that occurs that may be what shuts down or keeps a good idea from rising up. And so I think the biggest risk then that we face is that we really stop the legislating and it goes more towards a performance. You know, we get grandstanding instead of problem solving. And so I think over time that wears down institutional knowledge. And again, that's probably one of those things that is looked poorly upon. But I think we need a certain amount of institutional knowledge of folks that have been there for a while that bring the perspective of history to, especially with our long storied history in Wyoming and the way things have gotten done. And so it can scare off capable leaders. It leaves voters in a state of frustration. They become more disengaged. It's kind of a slow erosion until one day, you know, our system really lacks the trust to function.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you One of the tensions that you really point out in your piece that I liked was this, you know, kind of the tension between conviction and collaboration, sort of this idea of how do you and how should you stand by your principles, which I agree wholeheartedly, right? That, you know, we have, you know, you are a conservative, I'm a conservative, I'm a very conservative conservative, so are you. I have really strong convictions and principles about these issues, but how do you stand on those convictions and still sort of collaborate? Because I feel like strong principles really should lead to strong conversations, but not this all-out legislative war that we're seeing. And you've touched on some of the stuff. Some of it, I think, has gotten to the point of performative and really ridiculous. But I also think some of it has come a little bit outside of the system that you all are now living with, which is, you know, in the last couple of years, it has felt like all of our politics has been ratcheted up to, you know, this is the most important election of my lifetime. You know, this is the issue that will end America, right? And that kind of rhetoric is so dangerous. So how do you try to balance that? You know, you stand on this principle, you want to collaborate, but you don't want to become a performative, you know, you have that tension.
Right. I think it takes having a level head. Sometimes people can get pretty snarky in responses. We tend toward, I hesitate to say the word, but the extremism of the view to get our point across, taking the 1% case, the 1% scenario that if we do this, then the worst is going to happen. Or taking the worst case scenario that has happened and legislating to accommodate that. And so that's what we tend to see is people jump to that kind of extremism to get their point across, and it ends up being, and that's what the news likes. You know, they want to see the battles, they want to see the fights, because that's what sells the stories. But I think as I mentioned, it really leads to folks getting, it just becomes more and more noise, and they start to disengage because of that.
Yeah. You know, I've talked on some of my podcasts about Russell Kirk and some of the other conservative writers that talk about this idea of the ordered soul. And of course, it's a really important part of the first principles that conservatives hold, that we have this sense of there's a law higher than ourselves and that there's an order to us and to the things around us. I think that what I see is there's a lot of conservatives, many of whom I think don't want to go into politics right now or really aren't interested because they feel it'll force them into these kinds of performative things. I mean, I think it's important to talk about the ordered soul because it can't feel good to constantly be attacking and getting really, really nasty. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously it goes against the principles of Christianity to behave that way. And I think it really can affect folks. Are you feeling that? Are you seeing that?
You know, at times, yes. Me personally, it hasn't been as prevalent, but I've definitely seen it with some other folks in being attacked, and it's exhausting. You know, the way our session works in the first place, that we're packing so much into it. And then if we have that negativity and that those attacks that occur, it really starts to wear down and makes you question, why am I here? Why am I doing what I'm doing when I could be out running my business? I could be spending more time with family. I could be coming home and not worrying about what happened during the day and what's going to be, you know, what I'm going to be attacked on in the news tomorrow. And when I say me or us in general as legislators in this body. And so I think that, you know, taking a step back and remaining a little bit more calm and realize we are there to perform a job. There are many strong personalities that are in the legislature right now. And we do have, there's a lot of people that have very deep, solid core values that we need to acknowledge and need to understand, and we need to, and they may be at opposite sides to ourselves individually. And so, but if we just take the step back and realize we have an obligation, we have a duty to get work done in the best possible manner and to provide the solutions that need to be done. I think if we kind of tone down the rhetoric, it can help.
Yeah. So are there specific moments, and I have one if you can't think of one off the top of your mind, Rob, so I'm putting you on the spot here, but are there specific moments you've witnessed sort of that where collaboration could have happened, but it didn't because of sort of the factionalism you're seeing in the House? And I'm thinking particularly of an amendment you might have brought, but that's my one example. If you have one off the top of your head, Would love to hear it.
Well, you know, I go to one, actually I wrote an op-ed about it with the limiting the federal government from acquiring additional land in Wyoming. And in my view, it was more of an issue. There was one portion of the bill that really went against private property rights, limiting people to be able to do whatever they want to do with their land within reason. And that just didn't set well with me. And so I attempted to offer a couple of times some amendments, you know, behind the scenes and then on the floor to really try to get that particular issue taken care of. And because I wasn't necessarily part of the right faction or the right group of individuals, my approach was I guess set aside, if you will. There's maybe another particular one where I offered an amendment that had the same language that was previously approved, and I attempted to put that language back in. It just got missed, I think, on the new iteration of the bill, and so I tried to reintroduce that, and again, it was just voted down. I feel like because of who I was, not because of the idea.
Yeah, I mean, when I read your piece, and I just did a podcast a week or so ago, I talk a little bit about, because you point out so well that obviously when you take factionalism to its natural conclusion of behaviors, what comes out of that, you get this idea that you could have the dumbest, most dangerous idea, but if you're in the right faction, it's fine. And you've pointed out that bill trying to limit private property rights from a conservative perspective, you and I both realize is one of the most dangerous and dumb ideas I've seen in a long time in the legislature. And they do come up with some whoppers every now and again. And it just flew through the House. I mean, it just sailed through the House. It thankfully, mercifully died a beautiful death in the Senate where it needed to. But yeah, I was thinking in particular, you had an amendment, I believe, on a property tax, a piece of legislation that was voted down and the next day reappeared without your name on it, about the right faction names on it, and it passed. And that's the kind of stuff that's just so obviously factional. Like there's just, you can't deny the factionalism of that.
Right. Yeah. And there's been any number of instances, I think, where during the session, there were a number of people that weren't necessarily accepted by the majority that proposed some pretty good ideas. And you look around the body and people are not. And some of it had to do with even just explaining what this, the way the statute was written or the way it's been implemented, this is how it came to be. And people tune out and they just, because of the individual. Now, I'm not saying that there's not some other good reasons for it. There have been times where I think there may have been some excessively long descriptions or speeches made that really made people kind of tune out. But in other cases, I think even just taking the underlying idea of some of those times and it's just not, people don't pay attention because they're the wrong person.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I mean, obviously, one of the other logical conclusions to factionalism is not just that bad ideas can just sail through, but that good ideas can be utterly ignored and that people don't have to make, if you're in the right faction and if your faction happens to have a majority in the Wyoming House of Representatives, good ideas can just be completely ignored, or you don't really need to listen to your fellow colleagues maybe educate you on some past point because you already know I'm going to vote yes or no on this. My faction stands this way and I don't really need to know. And I made this point and I'd love to hear your thoughts about it, but that what it does is it really stops particularly new members from spreading their wings and growing as lawmakers, from really learning and asking a lot of questions, because a lot of questions don't really need to be asked if you're sort of told where your faction is going. And I mean, I love your thoughts about that because it seems to me that that's what is happening to some lawmakers on that floor, that they're not really digging in.
Yeah, I think that is the case. And it's even within, you know, perhaps a group that may have a majority vote on any particular issue, some of the folks that normally vote with that group are not going to listen and pay attention and try to educate themselves on the issue overall. And on the flip side, those folks that are trying to learn more, maybe ask some questions that haven't been thought of during the course of the process, maybe just have given up and have decided, you know what, I'm not even going to speak on this because it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. So Let's pivot. And in Federalist 10, you quoted Madison. I don't think it's this quote, but you quoted Madison because he wrote an entire, you know, Federalist 10, basically about factionalism. And in there, he says there are two methods of curing the mischiefs of faction. The one, by removing its causes, the other by controlling its effects. So what do you think? Let's just start with the question of how do you think lawmakers can work towards sort of rebuilding relationships specifically? And then we'll get into removing causes and controlling effects. What are your thoughts on what's the best way to sort of, and are you trying to practice that with some of these folks in sort of creating better relationships, working relationships?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I definitely, some of it has to do with building the individual relationships outside of being on the floor. And so whether it's in the break room or, you know, having lunch with somebody, you know, before the session, these are some of the things that I did in just trying to get to know some of the folks that I'm working with, build those relationships, see kind of what drives them and understand what the concerns might be. And then when the issues arise, you can go to them and say, hey, why is it that this is such a stumbling block for you? What have I not thought of? Help me to understand your perspective. And then you can still weigh that against your own convictions, you know, your own core values. I believe in strong convictions and I don't bend on those core values, but we do have to understand that part of governing in our system is about building coalitions, persuading people and listening. And there's a difference between those coalitions and factions. Coalitions are people that on any given subject might come together to say, this is the way we ought to go, versus a faction that says, I don't care what the underlying core values are, I'm going to just vote with my group. And so it's not about compromise for its own sake. It's really about finding the common ground to advance the principles in a real lasting way.
Yeah. I mean, so thinking about removing its causes, Madison's idea that the best way, one of the first ways to try to cure factionalism is to remove its causes. It really makes me think about, I did, after reading your piece and doing a podcast, and we're going to get in some eggheadery here for all those listeners to just get prepared, reading about nihilism and the nihilism that really kind of changed Europe after World War I, headed into World War II, and this idea that there was just a really sort of hopelessness and negative feeling. There was deep concern that communism was going to win. They saw monarchies, longstanding monarchies, fall all across Europe after World War II, before and after World War II. And it brought about this kind of hopelessness. And in many ways, we see some of that here in America, that a lot of people are angry. They're angry about where the country has gone. I mean, in Wyoming, we see it as well. What the nihilists really did wrong, and a lot of great, you know, political thinkers have sort of digested this and come up with these ideas, and I would agree with them, is that they never addressed the underlying fears. In other words, they understood that a lot of the solutions, I mean, obviously in Germany, the solution was to go to National Socialism under Adolf Hitler, and the anti-nihilists said, you know, this is a bad idea, and here's why, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, all the arguments, well-thought-out arguments, and they failed. Because none of those arguments addressed the underlying fears, the fears that people were having. I think that's something that we conservatives need to really understand and recognize, because I think we share a lot of those fears. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's well said. There is, I guess it seems to me that the difference that we're seeing now is that we've got just this speed of flow of news, of things, of rumors that are happening. In fact, I was just talking with my dad the other day. I'll probably get the quote wrong. I think it was Mark Twain said something about rumor is halfway around the world while truth is still tying his shoes.
Yep, you know? Yep.
And so we've got this speed of the information and the rumors that flow. And so people are afraid. They are afraid of some deep underlying thing that affects their core values that may or may not happen. And we have so much disinformation out there that is really playing on those deep underlying fears. Absolutely. And so we really have come to this place where that kind of thing is really triggering more and more. Even you look at some of the demonstrations that are happening today and the information coming out of those on both sides, and how much, yes. You know, you wonder how much of it is really truth. What is it that they're basing their support on or their protests on? Is it really, is there truth underlying what they think is going on? And so it's to take it then to the extreme. If we are not careful about that kind of thing, we can end up in a very awful situation. I guess I don't want to take it to an extreme. I won't go any further than that. I won't contemplate on what could happen. But let's just say that we're seeing some of the effects of that right now.
Yeah.
In the protests that are going on.
No, I mean, I agree. Again, this whole ratcheting up of rhetoric that somehow, you know, the most important election, or, you know, from the left that, you know, one president is somehow going to end this country as we know it. That kind of rhetoric is just dangerous and dumb and foolhardy. And I could go on and on and on and on. And I think it's going to take principled, you know, elected officials willing to stand up and say, yeah, no, that's just not true. It's just, it's not true. You know, let's get back to the sort of, you know, reasonable ideas of the country and not sort of keep ratcheting, because you're right. I mean, obviously we've seen protests on the left that are just silly. I mean, here at the Edmonds household, we were laughing because if you have any, you know, left-leaning friends, challenge them. Has there ever been a time when protesting or rioting, you know, stopping a car, you know, lines of cars of people trying to go to work so they can feed their families, has that ever changed somebody's mind? Ever? Ever.
You know, that sounds just like all the arguments that go on Facebook as well. Yes. When has that kind of back and forth ever changed anybody's mind?
No, that's so true. It's so true. It's the same idea. It just doesn't change people's mind, right?
Yeah.
And if you're stuck in some city across the country trying to go to work so you could feed your family, it doesn't change your mind, and it may actually anger you enough to suddenly look at this view differently, because it just doesn't work. I mean, it just doesn't work. It's silly. So what do you think? I mean, what are you thinking in terms of what role constituents and voters really play in all of this? I mean, not just you guys on the floor, but your voters, your constituents, and either reinforcing or rejecting, you know, factionalism. Because I think most voters, in some ways, I think we have voters who are very sort of caught up in this factionalism and this struggle. But I also think we have a lot of voters who don't care so much about the inner power struggles, look at headlines and are like, well, I don't even know what they're talking about. What they care about are results, right? They care that schools are good, roads are good, you know, that sort of thing. What do you think is the role for those folks?
You know, voters play absolutely a huge role. And I think when voters reward, you know, the people that actually turn out, when they reward the volume of noise over results, when that loudest voice in the room is seen as the strongest, that really reinforces the factional behavior, really. But when voters say that they want a leader and not a showman, it really sends a different signal. And so I think we need to, as the general public, I think we need to really think about what the source is, what the cause is, and look at who is the person making the most noise. Are they really trying to get things done, or are they just attempting to get elected? You know, it's sad when we see the showmen get up there and you know, do their little dance and yell and scream and pound their fist. And I think we as voters need to really look at that and challenge, is that really the person that I want leading?
Yeah. I think that's I think that's something we should all kind of soak in, this idea of focus on results and not on the noise, because there's just so much noise. One last question before we go. Are there any kind of institutional reforms that you see that might be helpful, like, you know, changing committee rules, the leadership process, obviously, or even norms within caucuses that might help ease this divide specifically in the Wyoming legislature?
You know, I think that really trying to encourage more diversity of view, if you will, in committee work. I would almost say bipartisan, but we really don't have much of a bipartisan makeup in the legislature. We really have a kind of a diversity of views that span from the far left to the far right. Encouraging more of the mix of those ideas to stimulate the conversation may be I don't know, gatekeeping might be a little bit too far of a term, but something along those lines that, you know, if we're only putting the issues forth that the faction is really concerned about, and the scheduling of all the bills, maybe that could help to have the diversity of issues that we need to tackle. But really, I think the most important thing is the culture. If we can, as individuals in the legislature, really focus more on having that tone of listening. We can still disagree. We can still have spirited debate. We can still stand on our core values, but at least listen to some of the options that are out there that might just make these bills a little bit better. And so if I guess I'd say, you know, reforms that we're trying to do won't work if the attitude really just stays adversarial.
Yeah. You know, a while back, you know, I don't know, it was probably 4, 5, 6 years ago, a lot of folks that my husband and I knew were reading this Rules for Radicals. I think it was a Saul Alinsky, something from the left, but they were reading it. And a lot of, I think, well-meaning conservatives started saying, hey, we should do this, right? And, you know, we were one of the first that were like, no, actually we shouldn't. Because here's the thing, if we become the very thing that we know is wrong to try to win, we haven't won. We've lost already, right? We've already lost. And so when we weaponize or change rules, when we get in power to, you know, because we've seen the folks, other side sort of do it, it's you know, you've already lost because you're not getting the things done in the manner in which you should. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that more for you all, obviously, as you said, culture is really important. Leadership is really important. The next group of folks that run for leadership in the House should have a really clear message about how they're going to handle collaboration, cooperation, what kind of culture, as you said, and how they're going to look at bills and apply the kind of fairness that needs to happen. Because if it's just more rules for radicals, we're not going to see change.
I would agree with you. And I think that people that really have a strong maybe opposition to a particular issue or bill may end up, I guess they, if the issue doesn't get heard fully, they feel cheated. So that we can still pass legislation, conservative legislation that makes sense, but let's at least give voice to the opposing view. Because if you do just win for winning's sake, then you are going to develop you're going to develop more opposition over time. You're going to have people just fighting to fight back because their issues haven't been heard. They want to have that voice. And so I think as conservatives in the legislature, obviously we have a conservative majority right now, but we are walking a line here where if we don't continue to at least hear the opposition, if we don't try to hear the voice, if we don't try to hear maybe some additional ideas that might make it better, then we run the risk of losing the people
Right. Because it makes you intellectually lazy, right? It's, you know, something that I've said continuously. If you are not reading and understanding your opponent's arguments, if you do not understand where they come from, and if you don't listen and read broadly, then you become intellectually lazy and you can't make those solid arguments. Even if you have a majority, and this was something, and we're getting off task, but I'm going there anyway. This was something that I noticed specifically about the ESA, the Education Savings Account bill that is now going to be litigated. Obviously, the teachers union just filed suit on the House side. I watched that discussion and I just had to stop myself from yelling at my computer while I watched it because you know, there's a faction that has the majority in the House and they have the votes. They did not get up and make the arguments that they should have made. And you are there, but you're also talking to every person out across the state. It makes you intellectually lazy when you have the votes and you don't think you have to make arguments, but you do. You always do, because iron sharpens iron. Always. And you are there to debate, and you take that debate outside of that chamber to every constituent you talk to, every event you go to where you have to make a speech. And if you don't have those talking points, then you're not going to persuade people. So yeah, that was my frustration. Right. Very frustrating.
Yeah, I get it. And you hear it when people are, whether it's one-on-one conversations or town hall meetings or whatever, op-eds in the newspaper or whatever, you do get that sense that people are frustrated. And it's, and if if we don't take the work on, if we become intellectually lazy like that, then it's going to be even tougher to get the other real issues done. And we're going to spend more time litigating. I can't say that it's, I just don't want to see more and more legislation being litigated because we're not exploring all of that's always going to happen. Right. If somebody is irritated enough, if a group, an opposing group is irritated enough, they're going to try to make the courts make the judgment. And that's just going to slow everything down. And so, yeah, we definitely need to stand up and be able to voice really why it is we're doing what we're doing, rather than just saying, let's steamroll this through and get it done and move on to other stuff.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think you're right. Litigation comes, but we've seen a really large uptick of litigation, whether it's in the pro-life sphere, now in the education sphere. And I think, you know, it's awfully convenient to just blame that on lawfare or whatever the buzzword is right now. But I think, you know, I know from watching the legislature, from reading those pieces of legislation and wondering why these questions weren't asked and weren't dealt with on the floor, that I think it's also a product of, as we said, people who might be intellectually lazy and aren't taking in everything they need to craft an excellent piece of legislation. Yeah.
Well said.
Representative Geringer, it is wonderful yet again to have you on. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that amazing op-ed piece. It was really, really good. I will link it in the show notes for all you listeners. Check it out. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
You bet. What Representative Geringer said today is something we should all sit with for a moment. The health of our institutions depends not on who wins the next floor vote, but on whether we still look each other in the eye and can talk. Factionalism isn't just a political annoyance, it's a slow-acting poison. Wyoming has never been a state that tolerates political gamesmanship for long because we're just too small, we're too local, we're too independent for that. Our future depends on whether we can rebuild the habit of trust and respect, even when we disagree, because disagreement is healthy. So the question isn't whether factions will exist, they always will. The question is whether our politicians will be ruled by them or whether they will remember who they work for, the people of Wyoming. Thanks for listening to Let's Talk Wyoming. If this conversation sparks something in you, share it. Talk about it. And as always, let's keep pushing for a politics that's tough, honest, and worthy of this great state. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.